This episode is made possible by StackAdapts. With the Creative Builder in StackAdapt, advertisers can easily build multiple ad creatives in many sizes, just a handful of clicks. The Creative Builder in StackAdapt, scale your design efforts, save time, cut costs, and simplify your workflow. You can learn more at go.stackadapt.com/creativebuilder. Head there, scroll down a little bit, and they've got a video, it's only 30 seconds, explaining everything. Much better than I just have. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen and e-marketer podcast made possible by StackAdapt. This is the Friday show that thinks everything's bad. All right, Bill.
All right.
What's wrong today?
I don't know, mate.
Okay.
Bill, it's February.
It's a bit drizzly in the UK. It's a bit depressing, the weather.
Isn't it always? Bill was like, I'm feeling a bit negative today. I was like, today? Just today, Bill? Normally so chipper. He's not. In today's show, what will be the best app experiences on the new Apple Vision Pro mixed reality headsets? Will instant AI generated videos be a hit? Do department stores have a path to relevancy? Are folks ready for shoppable media? And what does the marital status of folks look like in the US? Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our principal analyst, who is based in the UK, covering everything over there. He lives on the south coast of that country. It's the host of the Around the World Behind the Numbers show. It's Bill Fisher.
Hello, Marcus.
Hello. Hello. The effort you had to put into that was noticeable.
I tried.
We're also joined by someone else in that very country across the pond, also based on the south coast, one of our senior analysts covering retail and things in the UK. It's Karina Perkins.
Hi, Marcus. What a wonderful day it is.
Hello there. No, it's too much. You've overdone it. We're also joined by Ross Benish, who is based just above New York City, is one of our senior analysts covering everything digital advertising and media.
Hey, Marcus.
Hey, fella. Did I say your name? It's Ross Benish.
Yep, you said my name.
All right. It's twice. It's there twice. Just
said my name, say my name.
Good song. Destiny's Child.
Great song.
Yep. All right. So today's episode, what do we have in store for you? Story of the week. We'll talk a bit about Apple Vision Pro and the best use cases for it, why it's struggling, and what adoption will look like in a couple of years. We then move to the game of the week. We're talking about a lot of different topics, AI generated videos, department stores and shoppable media in our debate of the week segment. And we end with some random trivia. It's called Dinner Party Data. But we start, of course, with the story of the week. So what would we think if the Apple Vision Pro was the first VR AR headset? So this is the question I was posing, or the way I was framing this segment, because there have been so many bad versions of headsets that it's hard to take each one in isolation without having some preconceived idea or of what the other ones have been like, and bringing that disappointment along to the party when you're reviewing the latest version. We covered the new Vision Pro headset from Apple, mixed reality headset. We covered it when it hit the market at the start of the month. It describes itself as a spatial computer that seamlessly blends digital content with the physical world. Since it's launched, there've been a lot of articles that have been written about the experience, how it stacks up with the competition, and how it can or can't push the space forwards. But I want to try and be optimistic, because there's been a lot of criticism about the headset and why it won't work. We'll get to some of the barriers in a second, but trying to be positive, Bill and Ross, to be honest, you too, Karina, probably is not going to be the best question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So the new mixed reality headset is going to launch with 600, or has launched with 600 dedicated Vision Pro apps, but which app experience transfers to the Apple Vision Pro the best? So if you took one app out of your phone and had to experience that app in the headset most of the time, what's the best experience, Karina?
So I feel like this is a bit of a trick question because I think the best app will be one that is specifically designed for the Apple Vision Pro.
Oh, okay. Good answer.
I mean, I think at the moment, probably the best use case is gaming still. I know it's trying to be a computer. I'm not 100% convinced about that yet. Gaming. And because I'm not a massive gamer, the one app on my phone, which is game, is a chess game. So I'm going to say it would be quite fun to play my chess game.
Wizard's
in
chess.
The Apple Vision Pro.
Very nice. Ross.
Well, I was also going to say gaming. That seems like the most fun use of this. You know, I've seen the ads for this on TV, and they'll show someone like laying on the couch with the headset on, but then they're just watching the TV. They're looking up in the sky, watching the TV, and then they like zoom out and that person has a huge big screen TV on their wall anyways. So like, I'm not sure you're gaining a ton unless the show is interactive. And if you're getting to an activity, that to me seems more like video games. So the New York Times article you shared talked about the guy got a demo of a Super Mario's game, that Super Mario Brothers game, that seems like it'd be real fun. Most of the apps on my phone, I would not want them to be in 3D. Like, please don't bring work Slack like into a 3D headset wearing thing. That sounds dystopian.
What you just said about being interactive is quite interesting, because what if you could watch a sporting event and like there were cameras in, say, the helmets? I mean, I feel like the cameras everywhere, they're in the pylons, they're flying over the head on wires. What if there was a way that you could switch your views to be as though you were, you know, playing quarterback or playing D-line or moving around the field for different, from using different angles? Would that, some kind of interactivity? Obviously it's mixed reality as well, so you can have augmented reality, you could pull stats up maybe to the side of your actual TV screen.
But I mean, it would only be fun if you were just going to be watching the sporting event by yourself anyway, wouldn't it? I think that's kind of the problem here, that so, you know, watching a sporting event is often a bit of a social activity and you're all talking about what's on screen. And if you're all sitting there with headsets watching different things.
Yeah, that's a good point. I wonder what the numbers look like, though, in terms of people watching content by themselves and with other people. Now, sports lends itself very much to watching with other people or out in social settings. But it does feel like we are quite isolated in our content consumption anyway. So I do what people feel like a lot of the time. They're like, wow, I want to watch it with people. It's, do you actually watch stuff with people? Sports, perhaps. Netflix shows, maybe not as much. So I wonder if that would be as big of a problem as, you know, perhaps it should be.
No, I was thinking specifically about sports there. Yeah, I agree. For wider TV watching.
Yes.
Possibly, I guess.
Yeah, Ross?
I was going to say, it depends how many people are in your household. If you're a single guy with an apartment, I get your point. But if you have a spouse and kids and you're all watching the same cartoon, like, you probably don't want to have to buy four of those things.
That's true.
You just want to sit back and, you know, mindlessly watch Bluey or whatever.
Yeah. I wonder if there's going to be a way to sync the content between the two. So you could both have headsets on. Maybe that seems a bit ridiculous, but maybe then you'd have a more of a common shared experience. Bill, the best app experience. Jesus.
Look, I'm not going to be boring. I could just say gaming again, because I think that is the obvious answer. But listen, I'm going to go against the grain here, and I'm going to say I'm quite excited about video. I know what Ross is saying. You know, you get a big screen covering your entire wall with surround sound. You've got all that anyway. Why do you need a headset to do it? But I'm particularly interested by this, this sort of 3D video. So you can be immersed in some of the home video clips you've taken, for example. I know some of the reviewers have said it doesn't work that well, but I think when the tech to capture it catches up, I think that could be kind of nice. I mean, just think about it down the line, spending time with a loved one who maybe isn't around anymore, that you've captured in fantastic 3D detail and you're there with them, immersed in that environment. I think that's quite a nice thought. I don't think we're there with it yet, but we're getting closer with the Vision Pro.
Surprisingly optimistic, Bill. All right, folks, let's move to the barriers real quick. Aside from the $3,500 price tag, which is not terribly palatable, Karina, the main barrier to adoption?
But I think it's what we've said already is just the use cases are fairly niche, I guess. And it kind of really lends itself to people who spend a lot of time home alone, which is, I guess, gamers.
Isn't that everyone? Where do you live, Karina? I want to live in your society.
Well, I spend time home alone, I guess, working. So I guess, yeah, maybe I could use it to work. But I feel like it's solving a problem that I don't have currently working.
Right.
So I'm not convinced at the moment of the kind of ease of use, the practicality. Is it really going to improve my working experience? I don't think so much.
Yeah.
Like Bill says, I'm sure there are some cool future use cases. I just think where we're at now, I think it's a kind of novelty thing, which is the kind of thing you'd buy, spend a couple of weeks going, oh, wow, cool. And then it would just go to the back of your closet and not be used very much.
So that's kept. Oh, that is fun. Oh, so we've got some.
Sorry.
For Victoria, who edits the show, produces the show, and is experimenting, it seems, with sound effects. Once the timer's up, we're supposed to move on to the next segment. Instead of her screaming at us, she's put on some fun. Was that an accordion? That was fun.
The title of the track is Ooh La La.
Oh, yeah, I could see. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. All right, so we should be moving on. But really quickly, yeah, that's what Kevin Roos of the New York Times Karina calls 6-month problem. After buying a headset, the initial novelty wears off, the minor annoyances creep in, and then you 6 months later, it ends up in the back of your closet. So can folks get past that? The other thing you were saying, you know, not wanting to have to, like, wear it at home, they're not the lightest things in the world. And so having the idea of wearing that for long periods of time doesn't sound appealing. I mean, you didn't even want to put your regular glasses on for this episode. You came into the episode and had a face pressed up against the camera. Am I too close? So maybe that's a drawback too. Really quickly, Ross, the main barrier.
Nausea and discomfort. I haven't tried this particular headset, so maybe they'll blow me away. But whenever I've used VR headsets in the past, using them even as much as an hour can make you feel like you're gonna vomit. Like, it's a little disorienting, and that's been an issue with VR for a while. So if they can fix that, that'd be a huge step forward. But, you know, I think a lot of people are gonna struggle with dizziness and nausea.
Yeah, VR sickness for sure. Bill.
Well, firstly, that music's really cheered me up. So thanks. Oh, thanks, well, Victoria. That was great. Yeah. So I don't know, maybe I can be more positive now. What the guys have said, I don't really think there's a killer use case yet. I'm not quite sure what it's for, but, you know, these things start as toys, right? And people fork out all this money just to have the latest device. But when Apple joins a market, it tends to push things forward a little bit. So there might be something in there that takes off and then it finds its use case. But I don't know what it is yet.
Okay. Well, to that point, Apple pushing a market forward and it finding a way to work out. Hope King of Axios writes that this product category isn't going away, in her opinion. So really quick, folks, assuming that she's right, what does adoption look like by 2027? Adoption out of 10, obviously these things are going to iterate quite a lot, but do you see them still being niche? Do you see it being, you know, half of folks have one, every person? Where do you land out of 10, Karina, in terms of adoption by 2027?
Well, I think our forecast has US VR headset adoption at about 11% of the population in 2027. So I'm going to go for a generous 1.5 out of 10.
Okay, she's sticking close to the forecast team. Sensible. Ross?
I'm going with a 4. I think a lot more people will have them in 2027 than have ever had them before, but they're still, that's only 3 years from now. I don't see the price dropping to the point where, like, hundreds of millions of people around the world can afford this.
Yeah, and has them doesn't translate necessarily into using all the time. A lot of people have smart speakers, but how much they use them is a separate question. Bill?
Oh, I'm quite positive here. I'm going for a 4. Good as God. Well.
Is this globally? Are we talking globally?
We can.
Or in the US?
Let's talk about the U Hey, for you guys,
I'm still going to give it a four. I remember testing VR headsets. I want to say 8-9 years ago at trade shows when they were quite new, and they were honestly junk back then. And that they have come on so much. They really have. I know 3 years isn't long, but I just think it needs a few small advancements and it might pick up a little bit. And Apple's joined the party. And as we said, once Apple joins a party, it tends to push things forward.
Well, you started very negative. You've come a long way, but if I'm honest, it's a bit much. Turn it down. Too much positive.
Okay, sorry.
Settle down. All right, folks, that's all we've got time for the story of the week. Let's move to the debate of the week. Today's segment is called Make the Case. For our panel, Ross, Karina, and Bill present the for and against arguments for each of the following questions based on three news stories. Two contestants face off per question, and the following takes don't necessarily reflect the analyst's personal views. Their job is to just present the best case regardless and offer objective analysis. We start, of course, with question one. Who's going first? Karina against Bill. Instant AI-generated videos is our first question. OpenAI is launching a new AI-powered video generation tool called Sora that apparently is Sky in Japanese that can instantly create minute-long movies with complex scenes and multiple characters from just one line of text or a still image. Currently still in the research stage, so not yet publicly available. If you get a chance to look at these, it's quite remarkable and shocking at the same time. But the question is, will instant AI-generated videos be a hit? Karina is going to be arguing instant AI-generated videos will be a hit. A minute on the clock. Karina, make the case.
I mean, I guess it depends a little bit on how we define a hit, because I do want to caveat this by saying I think they're terrifying given the potential for deep fakes and impacts on people's jobs. But I think it's inevitable that we're going to see these videos adopted in marketing, advertising, film, TV. They are still very rough around the edges now, and there's some challenges to overcome. I think OpenAI says they don't understand cause and effect yet, so someone could take a bite out of an apple and it would still show the apple as whole. And they lack spatial awareness, but this technology is moving really fast, and I don't doubt that those will be overcome fairly soon. And this is the worst it's going to look. It's only going to get better from here on in. I just think the potential cost savings are so enormous that content creators aren't going to be able to ignore it. Sort of people that aren't using it are going to find themselves at a massive, massive competitive disadvantage. Mm.
Great takes. Bill, you're lucky this isn't a game. Whoa. Wouldn't be any point of you even going. But since it's not, Bill, instant AI generated videos will not be a hit. Make the case.
Okay. Caveat. I think they will eventually. All right. So that should cover my back. Karina's already alluded to this. I think there are too many really significant regulatory and legal issues that come with it. Absolutely, it's incredible. The samples that we've seen Sora produce are honestly incredible. Some of it's crap, though, as well. I saw a floating chair being excavated out of the ground today. But even with guardrails in place, which I know OpenAI is quite strong on, there will be ways to circumvent them. And so disinformation and, more importantly, illegal representation will be a huge risk. And where does responsibility lie? The AI tech owners will have to bear some of the brunt of that. So I think there's still quite a lot to sort out before this thing is fully let loose on the public. So it's not going to be a hit for some time yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very nice. Good comeback. She still won, but it was some good points. All right, folks, let's move to question two. Karina going up against Ross. Department stores' path to relevancy. Our Retail Briefings analyst Rachel Wolf writes that department stores are facing a slow, painful decline, with the U.S. Commerce Department reporting that Q4 sales for department stores fell 4% year on year. Rachel points out that Kohl's is facing calls from investors to sell. Macy's is fielding buyout offers. The question is there a path to department store relevancy? Karina is arguing there is a path to department store relevancy. Minute on the clock, make the case.
Okay, this is also going to be slightly caveated in that they have to do a fair amount to stay relevant. I think we've seen department stores in the UK facing similar struggles, and a few big names have gone under. I think part of that is just that they tend to be relatively expensive, and we've seen a big focus on the cost of living. The shopping experience is quite old-fashioned. It can be quite overwhelming. There's kind of too much choice. And their USP was really the convenience of having everything under one roof, but now people can shop online. That's no longer such a differentiator. But that all said, I think they can succeed if they really find a point of differentiation and focus on the kind of experiential elements of retailing and give a bit of theatre. And also, I think, have a bit more of their own brand and unique identity, which they often really lack. In the UK, Fenwick has just launched ads for the first time in its 140-year history, which I thought was really interesting. And finally, I think by forming partnerships with brands that appeal to younger people, because those are the people they really need to get in through the doors. I think we heard that Coles formed a partnership with Sephora, and I could actually see some real potential synergy between department stores and retailers or brands that don't have their own physical store. So it gives them a space for people who have discovered them on social media, perhaps, to go and see the products in person. And it will give that department store a kind of hip young audience.
Very nice. Sorry, this music.
You failed to recover after that, didn't you?
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Luckily, this isn't a professional podcast.
Are we going to keep the music in it? Because I was dancing to it at one point.
I think so, yeah. Okay, you basically got to get your answer in before...
We get fair use of that music.
Yeah, hopefully. B, can you just, like, as you just keep turning it up louder and louder, so you just play them off? I don't even know who's next. Ross, there isn't a path to department store relevancy. Make the case.
Well, there's only going to be more online shopping as we go into the future, and younger generations shop online more than older do. So, you know, when Gen Z becomes the dominant generation of the world, they're going to be really accustomed to online. In-store experience hasn't really evolved enough to appeal to them. And I expect that large e-commerce players like Amazon will continue to get away with murder in how they can treat their workforce and get away with, like, I wouldn't call it tax fraud, but they have a huge advantage over brick and mortars. They have for years. I expect them to maintain their advantages there, and that will only incentivize more online shopping. But it really depends on what area of retail you're talking about. Like, car dealerships, grocery stores aren't going to go away. GameStop probably isn't going to exist a whole lot longer.
Mm-hmm. My thing here, though, is that people do quite like going to the shops. Even younger generations, don't they? That's what people do on the weekend. Go to the shops.
Well, yeah, so that's a fair point. I was the last to reply to the email.
People need things to do on the weekend, I think. So
I have some numbers on that. So young people like stores, it seems. 42% of US Gen Z clothing buyers said browsing in store their top discovery channel, more than brand sites and apps, social media, family and friends, word of mouth, as according to our September survey. And then Marigold, and also retail consulting group Finn, might pronounce that wrong, found 47% of young Gen Z people said they prefer to shop in store over online as more than any other generation.
So, well, that just negates everything I said.
Yeah. Sorry, Ross.
Sorry, Ross.
Was anyone else, though, watching the clock, just hoping it got to zero so we could hear the music again? I was half paying attention to what you said, Ross. You might have said all that stuff I just said.
Yeah, that's it's hard, really hard for me to go longer than a minute.
Damn it. We'll try harder next time. The music's brilliant. Let's go to Ross versus Bill for question three. Are folks ready for shoppable media? Our senior retail analyst, Blake Drosch, just wrote a piece about whether the success of social commerce will spread to other channels. He notes that shoppable media formats are becoming available across different media, from CTV ads with QR codes to live stream shopping to online recipes that include links to purchase sites. All of these are types of shoppable media. But Blake questions whether consumers will want to buy products via media that they consume. Ross is going to argue folks are ready for shoppable media. Make the case.
Well, Amazon's getting into television in a huge way with all the live sports they're doing and inserting ads into Prime Video. And as they become a bigger TV player, they're going to get the consumer ready for shoppable media. I'm not suggesting that people are going to be in love with shoppable ads, but they're going to be really accustomed to them because they're going to be seeing them more often than they ever have before. They've been getting them on their phones and on their desktop already, but, you know, it's come into these other media formats like audio and video in a way that to a degree that it hadn't been there before.
Okay. Bill.
That was quick.
You're arguing, yeah, folks, too quick. Talked about this, Ross. Bill, folks.
You can give me a 30-second timer.
For Shoppable Media. Make the case.
Okay. Gartner says so. That's why. So in its latest hype cycle, Shoppable Media currently sits in the trough of disillusionment. For those of you who don't know the Gartner hype cycle, it drills down into the 5 key phases of a technology's life cycle. The trough of disillusionment sits right in the middle. And in its words, that's when interest wanes and experiments and implementations fail to deliver. Producers of the technology shake out or fail. Investments continue only if the surviving providers improve their products to the satisfaction of early adopters. And that's the problem. There's no, to my mind, mass improvement in this tech across providers. So consumers aren't seeing consistently good experiences. So interest is going to wane. It's a bit of a chicken and egg scenario. You need the tech to build the interest, but they'll only build the tech if there's enough interest. But essentially, it's up to the commerce and media providers to build better connected experiences. And that hasn't happened yet. So that's why there's consumer apathy.
Keep going. Keep talking. There it is. Well played. Okay. Well, yeah, it depends who you ask, it seems. That's really interesting. But industry folks, ad folks, nearly 6 in 10 ad agency folks think shoppable video content will be the next frontier. According to June Research, the Path to Purchase Institute, in terms of how many people are shoppable media folks, there's quite a lot, but little growth coming down the road. Our forecast team thinks 44% of digital buyers will be shoppable media people this year, but in a few years' time, that share barely budges. I wonder if shoppable is the problem, and we should focus more on the interactive portion, because according to our survey, after discovering a new brand or product from a CTV ad, most folks will first Google it, and then check it out in store, 38% each. Then they'll do a whole bunch of other stuff before you get all the way to the bottom of the list, which is less than 4% of people saying they buy it right away. So I wonder if they shoppable media should just be interactive media and shouldn't focus so much on driving sales, but driving engagement. So discount codes, free trials, booking test drives. What do we think?
Well, those ads are going to be more shoppable if you're doing like a direct response sort of thing. Like the types of TV ads you used to see was like 1-800 call, you know, call this number and you're going to get this product Billy Mays is selling. That's very shoppable. When you're just branding something, like Nissan has a new automobile, you know, I just want you to be aware of it and show how sexy our brand is. Like you're not going to just chuck that into your Amazon cart. Like that's just more for generating awareness. So,
right.
You know, really,
it depends on the categories, right? If it's the kind of impulse purchase, then that's infinitely more shoppable than a car.
Yeah. I wonder if like Starbucks had a TV ad and they, you know, if you got to the screen in time and scanned the QR code, you got a free drink. You know, something where it's engagement, it's not necessarily shoppable, but interactive.
I think it would work if you could get one delivered to your house within, you know, half an hour. You look at something, you see an ad, and you're like, oh, I really fancy one of those. And it's there.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a drink,
I could see that working,
thing.
Kind of quick commerce type thing.
Interesting.
I think it's dependent on the media as well. So this is where TikTok comes into play again. I have to talk about TikTok at least once every podcast.
Yeah.
Are they paying you, Bill?
They bloody well better be.
But this is the type of media where it's the way I use it, though. I use it different for my kids, and I look at how-to videos and things like that. I can't do DIY, so I have all this DIY stuff coming at me. And if I see something that's really useful, I buy it. Well, I don't actually, but I would. I might be persuaded to if it was shoppable.
Mm. Okay. That's where we leave the debate of the week, folks. Great arguments. We move now, though, to dinner party data. It's the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. Let's start with Ross.
So this holiday weekend, I was looking to walk around with my daughter, but it was cold outside and the library was closed. So drove to Nyack, New York, and walked around the Palisades Mall. And I was like, this is a huge mall. You know, I'm very tired. I've been walking around for hours and I didn't even see the whole thing. So I wanted to see, where does that stack up compared to the rest of the malls in the United States? And I learned from a Business Insider article that it's the 12th largest mall with about 2 million square feet of retail space. And the top mall, you're probably not going to be surprised, is the Mall of America in Minnesota. That has over 5 million square feet of retail space. And the second is the American Dream Mall that opened recently in New Jersey. It's way smaller than the Mall of America, but significantly bigger than the mall I went to. It's about 3 million square feet of retail space. So what I'm saying is America has some really huge malls. They have at least a dozen malls at over 2 million square feet. They will take the life out of you if you spend all day in them. That's the music just like you wanted, Marcus.
Thank you. Ross's vibe is like a number three on the list is one Chicago. Number four.
How does it compare to Westfield, do you think? That's our biggest one, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know, because I only looked at I was American-centric here.
It won't be anywhere near that big.
Wait, Karina, do some live research. We'll go to Bill next. Maybe you can tell us in a few minutes' time. That's a great question, though, because isn't Westfield... It was the biggest mall... So there's two in London, right? West and East? I don't think there's any more. And one of them, I think it's the one in the East that they built kind of in part because of the Olympics. But I think it's the biggest in Europe for a while. So it's big. But yeah, how it stacks up against the US, I'm not sure. Bill, do you want to go? We've got it ready.
It's Westfield, London is Europe's largest shopping and leisure destination at 242,000 square meters.
Okay, so just a little bit smaller. Fair enough.
But that, you know, I was talking feet.
That's
though.
That's a bit embarrassing, isn't it?
Square your feet. Meters.
Oh God, now
no. Square meter. So to feet, that would be like
just time
between 700,000 and 800,000 square feet. I think.
Yeah. So pretty small.
That's smaller than the mall I went to yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that one's chaos. Westfield's a disaster, and it's also multiple floors, right? In the US,
once you get beyond 100,000 square meters of retail space, I think you have enough.
Probably as much as you need.
Yeah.
Go.
Okay. So, given we've been talking about VR and digital video, I'm going to have a fact that covers both. Do you remember the early 90s movie, The Lawnmower Man? One of your favorites, right?
Yeah. No. Never saw it. Jim Carrey?
No.
It's not Jim Carrey?
I don't think so.
I might think of a cable guy. Yeah.
Maybe.
Never mind.
Anyway,
I haven't seen the film, which is evident from my response.
This was a movie that told of the perils of virtual reality. It was based loosely on a Stephen King novel. Anyway, the CGI used in that movie only accounted for 8 minutes of screen time, and it cost $500,000 at the time. That was quite a lot of money, certainly for such a small amount of footage. Of course, generative AI could probably knock that up in a matter of minutes nowadays with a much, much smaller price tag.
8 minutes.
It was a terrible film, I should say.
38% on Rotten Tomatoes, if you believe in that. It's because Jim Carrey wasn't in it. That's why.
Because Pierce Brosnan was in it.
Oh, shots fired. Oh,
Pierce Brosnan, incidentally, there was a sequel, which was even worse than the first, and Pierce Brosnan couldn't do it because he was doing his first Bond, I think. So I think he made the right choice.
GoldenEye?
Yes.
So good. Yeah. But wait, there's a Lawnmower Man 2?
Yep.
That doesn't need to be, does it? I haven't even seen the first one. But
you're talking about Lawnmower Man 2?
Hmm.
You've seen the film?
Yeah, I have seen both Lawnmower Mans.
Lawnmower Man?
Yeah.
Huh. Thoughts?
That's what we're talking about, right?
Unfortunately, yes, that is where we've landed.
Because the second one, you know, really did a lot worse than the first one, and the villain's like whole like goal is to take over the world and be the only thing left in cyberspace, right?
Lawnmower Man? It's about a guy in the suburbs.
It's not quite The Shining, is it?
No. All right. Who's next? Is that everyone?
No, me.
Karina, sorry. Sorry, because you were giving you did the more thing, but you were helping
I was
out
just
with
adding
sorry.
On.
Sorry, go on.
Okay, so it's a leap year, which means we get an extra day. So I found lots of other things that happen in a day. The world population will grow by 200,000 people. More than 41 million trees will be cut down. We'll all laugh 15 times. We'll kiss on average 3 times, exchanging 30 million bacteria. Our hearts will beat around 100,000 times. A mayfly will live its entire life. Our blood will travel 168 million miles. And our kidneys will filter 3,000 pints of blood. Cats will sleep for 17 hours. Sheep around the world will yield 5,000 tons of wool. Hens will lay nearly 2 billion eggs. Over 4 million tons of rubbish will be thrown out. And the really key one here, 900,000 golf balls will be sold.
I thought you were going to end with Anna Partridge. In a pear tree. That was really good. What was your favorite one? The bacteria one was rough.
Yeah, that was a rough one. I thought 41 million trees was sad.
Yeah, that's terrible. 200,000 people? New people?
New people, yeah.
That's too many.
Hmm.
Yeah, I feel like the planet's full. All right.
There you go. Extra day. That's what you get.
All right. Happy weekend, everyone.
Enjoy your golf balls.
All right, I got one for you real quick. Marital status. In the US, couldn't find any UK numbers. If the UK folks know how to pull some up quickly. Wonder how, maybe I should have done that, seen how this compares. But anyway, let's have a look. America. Over half of Americans are not married. Okay, you're not as surprised as I was when I read that. Fair enough. B, if you can cut in a... 51% of Americans are married. Then the other half divided into 34% have never been married, 10% divorced, and 5% widowed, which is heartbreaking. Women are widowed at 2.5 times the rate. Men, I think 4% of all men widowed, 11% of women. Yeah, because they live a lot longer. Yeah, my friend was like, I feel like I'm getting close to middle age, and I was like, mate, I think you're way past it. Like, if you're expecting to live a lot longer than the average, and he was like, all right, maybe I am close to it. Maybe I'm hoping to live to, like, you know, like 79, 70. I was like, you're also not a woman, so, you know, like, you men, you just keep going down. He's probably got about a few years left, if I'm honest.
Wow.
It's a harsh reality, but he had to know it. Karina, sorry. Yeah.
46.9% of people in England, Wales were married in 2021.
Okay.
And that's down from 49.4% in 2011, okay, over a decade.
Okay.
And 37.9% of people in 2021 have never been married.
37. Okay. So a few points higher on the marriage, few points lower on the never been. Okay. Interesting. Well, the marriage rate is falling in the US. Back in 1980, 6% of Americans aged 40 and up had never been married. 6%, 40 and up, never been married. Today, 25%, according to Pew Research. So that's 4 times higher. And folks waiting longer to get married. In 1980, from 1980 to today, the share of adults who were married by age 25 has plummeted from 66% of people being married by the age 25 in 1980 to 22% today. Over that time, the average age of marriage has gone from 23 to people getting married on average closer to 29 today. That's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to everyone for hanging out today. Thank you to my guests. Thank you to Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Turned out to be a pleasure. Wasn't so sure in the beginning. Thank you to Ross.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you, of course, to Karina.
Thanks, Marcus.
And thank you to Victoria, who edits the show. James, who copy edits it. Stuart, who runs the team. Sophie, who does our social media. And Lance, who runs our video podcast. Thank you to everyone for listening in. Come hang out with us on Monday, if you want. You don't have to. For the Behind the Numbers Daily, an e-marketer podcast made possible by StackAdapt. Happy weekends.